guys. Well, I tell you what, I've been hearing what a great, great time you have in your chapels here, and now I certainly understand why, and to be able to hear the music this morning and to be able to catch just a little bit of your enthusiasm today is indeed contagious, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to be here. My name is Ike Reichard. It's not a very easy name to say. The first time I met Billy Graham, I was so nervous I introduced myself as Ike Reichard. And Dr. Graham said, "Reich's an unusual name," and I said, "Yeah, ain't it?" So if any of you happen to run into Dr. Graham, you tell him Reich's doing good. It is a delight to be with you today, and of course, I was also delighted when I found out that Dr. Patterson was not going to be here today, and he can't stand strong gospel preaching, so I knew he'd wimp out and find somewhere to be today, but I do see the other good Dr. Patterson is with us this morning, and I appreciate that, and Carmen and Mark, two of my close friends. Carmen used to come spend some summers with us and our family, and so they're like my family, and Dr. Patterson, Lord only knows the things in the future when we look back to see the way that he was used in the life of the Southern Baptist denomination, and now to see the way that he's being used here at the seminary is indeed exciting. And so I'm thrilled to be with you this morning. I want to tell you a little story, kind of set up what I'm going to talk to you about today. A few years ago, my family and I were invited to the First Baptist Church of Leesburg, Florida, to do a revival. The pastor there, his name is Charles Rossell. He said, "Ike, if you want to, you can stay out at one of the hotels near Disney." It just so happens that another good friend of mine and a former church member happens to be the director of marketing at one of the Disney hotels called The Swan. And so I called him. His name is Brian Giott. And I said, "Brian, I'm going to come down and preach at First Baptist Leesburg, and I'm going to stay there at your hotel." And he said, "Well, man, that's great. You'll have a great time." And it was really neat because if you're going to go to any of the Disney attractions, they would have different types of transportation that would come and pick you up. For instance, if you were going to go over to the Magic Kingdom, they'd send this little brightly colored bus over that would get you. If you were going to go to Epcot, they'd send over a tram. And if you were going to go to Disney MGM, that was really neat because they would send this boat over to get you that was real sleek and sharp. The hotel is right on a lagoon. And so on this particular day, we're going over to Disney MGM. And so we go down and we get on the little boat. And it's got a little platform area back there on the back where you can walk out, get some fresh air if you desired, and so otherwise it's an enclosed cabin with benches, and we had just sat down, and the little guy, I guess he was the captain of the boat, began to give some announcements, and he said, "Now you need to remember that this boat will run every 30 to 45 minutes, and then you need to plan on about another 30 minutes for it to make all of its stops, and so be sure and plan your day accordingly." And so I kind of mentally filed that away, which means I totally forgot it. And so we went to Disney MGM. We'd had a great day. We got picked to do some things. It was a lot of fun. And all of a sudden, when we got through eating supper, I looked down at my watch and realized that we were running really late. As a matter of fact, I was running so late that if I really didn't hustle, I wasn't sure if I was going to get to the service on time. So I reached over, grabbed my wife, kissed her, kissed my girls on the forehead, and I said, "Look, I'm going to run out there and jump on the next boat. I said, if y'all can make it, great. If you don't, that's fine, but I've got to be on the next boat." And so I started jogging out of Disney MGM, and just as I hooked a left, I looked up, and as I went out the gates, I looked up, and to my horror, the boat was leaving the dock. Now, there was already a big crowd waiting on the dock. There was already a big crowd on that boat. But the good thing was the boat was only about 3 or 4 feet away from the dock. And I made one of those instantaneous decisions. I decided that this squatty body was going to be on that boat. Because you see, you had a little platform and everything, and the boat was kind of down from it, and so I started running as fast as I could, which for most of you is a brisk walk. And so as I started running, I hit the gangplank, and when I hit the gangplank, a little guy in a white uniform looked up, saw me running down the gangplank, and he started going, "Oh no, oh no, oh no." And I said, "Buddy, I've got to go. Y'all should have been there. It was a thing of beauty." As I begin to sail across the water, little dolphins are jumping beneath my feet. Sunlight glistening off of my Nike Air Jordans. Hey, who says white men can't jump? Give us a rap. watch us go. Now, of course, some of you are thinking you landed in the lake. No, I was going to land on the platform on the back of the boat that I'd mentioned earlier. However, there was a big crowd on that platform back there. But when they looked up and saw me coming, it was like Moses at the Red Sea. I mean, all of a sudden, the people just parted, and someone said, UFO. They were right. Unbelievably fat object is now coming off that starboard side. They just kind of part. I land in the middle of the back of the boat. My momentum is carrying me, and I'm running across the boat, and there's this big old guy that's standing there, and he's wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt. He's in his 40s, and he's got on a set of the ears, and he's eating an ice cream cone in the shape of Mickey Mouse, all right? So he sees me coming, he yanks out that ice cream, he throws open his arms, and he grabs me, and he keeps me from going over the side. Well, I thought this was just hysterical, and so I'm laughing, nobody on the back of the boat's laughing, and I said, I know I look like I'm an idiot, but I'm a Baptist preacher. You're right. They looked at me and like, and exactly what would that difference be? And I really didn't have a good answer, so I started laughing. I said, I know I look really stupid. I said, but I have to get to a speaking engagement. If I didn't get on this boat, I was going to be late, and so I had to make sure that I could get on this boat. The guy eating the ice cream cone kind of pulled it out again, and he looked at me, and he said, preacher, I don't want to disappoint you, but this boat's going into that dock. It ain't going out. That's what you call a Kodak moment right there, just in case you're curious. And then I suddenly realized the boat is backing up to the dock, and now all the people on the dock are applauding as I begin to back up toward them. So, you know, sometimes you don't know whether your boat's coming in or going out. Amen? I mean, y'all been there before, right? Well, I want to help you know where your boat's headed today. So what I want to talk to you about for a few minutes this morning is about how to have the value of a vision and what the value of a vision is really all about. I want you to go to one of the greatest visionaries in all the Bible by going to the book of Joshua, chapter 1 this morning, and I'm going to take you through the first 9 verses today, and I want to show you the way that God gave to Joshua an absolutely tremendous vision of what he could be able to accomplish, not only in his own life, but in the life of the nation of Israel. Now, you and I both know that Proverbs chapter 29, verse 18 tells us that without a vision, the people will perish. And if you were to have a reversal of that phraseology, you could say that with a vision, the people will flourish. And so when you get a great vision, it's incredible what can happen. I'll share a story with you that most of you have probably not heard about the Olympics that are coming to Atlanta, Georgia. The gentleman who dreamed up the idea of the Olympics coming was a former football player at the University of Georgia by the name of Billy Payne. And Billy Payne was serving in his church, a Presbyterian church, on a capital stewardship campaign and a building committee for his church. And they had gotten all of the work done. They had raised all of the money. They were sitting in a church for the dedication service on a Sunday morning. And as Mr. Payne was sitting there thinking about how wonderful this event had been for his church and about how everyone had pulled together and done all of these incredible things, he started asking himself, what kind of a mission could a city undertake in order to bring the same kind of unity across cultural and racial lines, across all different types of lines socioeconomically? And as he was sitting there thinking about it, according to the story that I read in a Delta Sky magazine several years ago, Billy Payne said, I took out my bulletin and I started scribbling some different ideas on it. And he said, I wrote down different words. Like I wrote down the word Super Bowl. I wrote down the word NCAA Final Four, about trying to get the Final Four in Atlanta. And then he said, I wrote down the word Olympics. And he said, when I wrote down the word Olympics, it was like God impressed on my heart and burned in my mind that this was to be the quest that I was to undertake. And so Billy Payne, sitting in church on a Sunday morning, received what he describes by his own words as a God-given vision to be able to bring the Olympics to the city of Atlanta. You know, it's amazing to me, and it is very mystical in its own way, that once we clarify a vision and we begin to refine that vision, that events beyond our control begin to take over and things begin to happen in our life that we could have never orchestrated in a million years. And some people say, well, you know, that's just a coincidence. Now, you know what a coincidence is? That's just when God chooses to remain anonymous, and he kind of nudges the angels, and he says, y'all, watch this. And whoosh, God just puts everything together just right. When you've got a God-given vision, and I'm talking about that God has given you a dream, that God has given you a mission, that God has given you a vision, that you have refined and you know that this is my purpose in life, it's incredible the way that God can begin to move in your life. Now, always understand that when you've got a God-given dream, that there are cycles that you're going to go through. And if you're a note taker, let me encourage you to get ready to take some notes this morning, because I'm going to share a way that you can get a God-given dream this morning that you can accomplish in your life and you can accomplish in the life of a church. And you can see things happen that people would have never dreamed in a million years could take place. And I'm going to share those things with you this morning from my heart that I've watched God do in my life, and now I'm trying to do again in the life of the First Baptist Church of Atlanta at their North Campus. And this is where I'm preaching right now. And to me, preaching is what you and God are talking about all week long. So over the last few months, God and I have been talking about the book of Joshua. And he's been showing me some things in the book of Joshua that have absolutely amazed me in the way that you can begin to establish that vision. Now understand that anytime you have the birth of a vision, there's a cycle that you're going to go through. There's going to be the birth of a vision. There will be a time when there is the death of a vision. And then there'll be the time that there is the rebirth of a vision. Anytime you have a God-given vision, you might as well mark it down in your mind. You might as well mark it down in your heart. You have an adversary that wants to destroy that dream that you have. And when you get out into the church world and you begin to pastor, or you go on a staff, it doesn't take you very long to understand that you do not struggle against flesh and blood. But there are powers, and there are principalities, and there are elements that are going to come against you. But if you have a God-given dream, if you have put in the time on the front end to know that this is from God, then you're not going to let go of your dream, even when it appears that your dream has died. Now, there is the birth of a vision, and there is the death of a vision. Let me give you a great passage to look up later. It's in Habakkuk chapter 2, beginning in verse 2. Let me just read it for you. Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 2. Then the Lord answered me, and he said, write the vision, record the vision, and inscribe it on tablets. There is something about writing down, whether you call it your goals, whether you call it your dreams, whether you call it your vision, there is a power in the written word. And God says, take that vision, take that dream and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. You know what that means? That means that you've got a goal to run for. That you've been given something in your life that gives you a goal that you're running for in life. And too many people are like, you get in the car and you get lost. Have you ever noticed that when you're in a car and you're lost, you drive faster? Have you ever noticed that before? When you get lost, you drive faster, which just means you're getting where you really don't know where you're going in record time. That's the way some people live their lives. It's absolutely incredible. So you're going to have sometimes the birth of a vision. But now then, listen very carefully. You'll have the death of a vision. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward a goal, and it will not fail. And though it tarries, wait for it. In other words, there'll be the death of a vision, there'll be that birth, and then there'll be that death of a vision when you start wondering if somehow that God has totally forgotten about you, that somehow this vision that you had that you just knew was from God doesn't seem to be coming about. And so we get locked in that struggle of saying, God, why didn't you answer my prayers? Now, you and I know in rational thinking that God answers prayers in four ways. Sometimes God answers prayer by saying no. Absolutely not. No is an answer. Let's just say my daughter said to me this weekend, let's go to Six Flags, and I can tell you what my answer is going to be, no. And let's say they come back in a few hours and say, Dad, are we going to go to Six Flags? And I look at them and say, no. In a few more hours, they come back and they say, Dad, when are you going to give us an answer? Now, what do you think I'm going to tell them? I've already given you an answer. And the answer is no. There's going to be times that God answers your prayers by saying no, absolutely not. And anytime God says no today, it's for a better yes tomorrow. You can trust God with the planning of your life. Now, the second way that God answers prayer is that sometimes God just says slow, S-L-O-W. That means the timing's not right. Something hasn't come together. Something is just not quite there. There's going to be times that God says, just slow down. And understand that detours are not denials when God's giving you that dream. Sometimes God's going to say to you, he's going to say, just slow down. Third way that God answers prayer, he'll say grow, G-R-O-W. If slow means the timing's not right, grow means you're not right. See, there's going to be times that God is going to slow you down in your pursuit of things. But let me tell you something. If you are a leader, you trust me on this one, your time will come. If you are faithful to God and you're preaching the word and you're being the man, the woman that God has called you to be, at the right time, God is going to open your door of leadership. God always does. And then sometimes God just answers prayer by saying, go, just go. But there'll be the birth of a vision. There'll be the death of a vision. Now listen to the rebirth of a vision from Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 3. Though it tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come. It will not delay forever. It's going to get there, and it's going to come around. Well, Helen Keller was once asked the question by kind of a callous reporter. He looked at her, and he said, what could be worse than being born blind? And she looked at him and said, to have sight and to have no vision. So a mission, a goal, a dream, a purpose, whatever it is you want to call it, the value of a vision is this, that you will be willing to give up all that you have now in order to accept all that you can become. Danny Aiken and I were talking about that a little while ago. And he was talking about how difficult it is for him to leave this seminary. Now, it's not near as difficult for you to have him leave this seminary as it is for him to leave the seminary. And he was talking about how wonderful the chapel services are and how much he loves you and all the miracles that you've seen God do. But God laid a calling upon his heart, and he's willing to give up everything that he has now in order to accept all that he can become. And that's what a vision will do for you in your life. But you see, most of us live so beneath that. Hudson Taylor once said, the great missionary to China, he said, many Christians estimate difficulty in the light of their own resources. And thus, he said, we attempt very little. And then he said, and even what we do attempt, we fail. All giants, all great men of God, he says, all giants have been weak men who did great things for God because they reckoned on his power and his presence to be with them. If you're going to have a great vision, let me give you several things. Number one, you got to have a purpose that's compelling. You got to have a purpose that is compelling. Joshua chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, let's read those 9 verses. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, who was Moses' servant, and he said, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now. Now that word now is only 3 letters, but that is a huge word. He's saying there is an end of an era, and now we're going to start on something brand new. Now, he says, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all of these people, to the land which I'm giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all of the land of the Hittites, as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun, will be your territory. Verse 5, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you. I will not forsake you. And now God begins to give him encouragement in verse 6. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. You know what courage is? It's nothing more than fear that said its prayers this morning. That's all in the world courage is. Nothing more than fear that just got up this morning and said its prayers and got ready to go out there and to face the day. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of their land, which I swore to their fathers to give to them. Again, reiterated, only be strong, be very courageous, be careful according to do all that is in the law, which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you will have success wherever you go. And this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you're going to meditate on it day and night, so that you will be careful to do according to all that is written in it. And then look at this piece of psychology that God gives us. For then you will make your way prosperous and you will have success. God says, if you do what you're supposed to do, then you will be prosperous and you will have success. You see, to me, success is finding God's will and doing it. To me, real success is doing the very best I can every chance I get with what I have been given. That's what success is all about to me. And to you, I'm not sure what your definition would be today, but I want to be able to have what God has promised me. And basically what he says right here is what I tell teenagers across America. I say, if you don't hear anything else I say, hear this one thing. Your choices today are going to equal your lifestyle tomorrow. And there's no way to get around it. Your choices today will equal your lifestyle tomorrow. Verse 9. Have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. When you have a purpose that's compelling, several things happen. Number one, it will require godly obedience. Now you see, God himself in the first 9 verses gives the commissioning service to Joshua, and the call is crystal clear. There was already a committee of 70 that had been appointed by Moses, but that was not who God was going to appoint to lead the nation. As a matter of fact, Moses himself said, God, I don't want to make the decision on who to appoint. God, you make that decision. And when God tapped Joshua and said, you are the man, Joshua never hesitated, he never vacillated, and when God spoke, there was no neutrality on his part. Always remember that God will call the individual. God calls that man or woman who's willing to listen to his voice and knows how to recognize his voice, and God will call you, and when he calls you and he gives you a purpose that is compelling, you're going to have godly obedience to carry it out. Do not be guilty of the sin of partial obedience. Too many people think, oh, I can be partially obedient to God. When you try to be partially obedient to God, you are totally disobedient to God. If you're going to have a purpose that's compelling, you've got to have godly obedience. Number two, when you have a purpose that's compelling, it will reveal great obstacles. There were all kinds of obstacles right here that Joshua was going to have to overcome. For instance, there were 7 Canaanite nations that occupied the land. One particular writer that I was reading about said there may have been in excess of 70 kingdoms within the land and 7 Canaanite nations that were there. But when there is a call on your life, it will always produce a divine enabling. And whatever God commands you to do, God will empower you to carry it out. If God has called you to it, then God is going to empower you. So you have to ask yourself, is this a call in my life, or is it just a holy hunch that I'm going with? Is it a mystical maybe? This is what God wants me to do? Or do you know that it is a call from God? Well, the other thing that Joshua had to face here with a purpose that's compelling is not only did he have to have godly obedience, not only did he see some great obstacles, but let me tell you what God does in an interesting way. He gives him a goal orientation. Let me show you a 7-step process that'll go just like this to being able to achieve your goals, that is, to carry out your vision. Number one, identify your goal. Now let me show you the way that God does this all the way through this particular chapter. He says in verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore, arise and cross this Jordan. He gives him and he identifies the goal. He says, I want you to arise, and I want you to get these people across the Jordan River. He identified the goal. It does not matter that for 40 years, Moses had attempted the same goal. When God said to Joshua, you're the man that's going to lead them into the land of Canaan. I have sovereignly chosen you. I have decided to bestow divine favor upon your life. Joshua did not argue. Joshua accepted the command of God. If you're going to be that godly person, number one, you've got to learn to identify your goals in life. You see, you're either going to live your life by default or you're going to live it by design. And that's just the bottom line. You're going to live it by default or you're going to live it by design. Identify your goal. Number two, if you're going to be a goal setter, isolate the obstacles. What are the obstacles that keep you from being able to accomplish what you want to accomplish in life? Let me tell you the obstacles that this man faced. Number one, he faced the Jordan River. And the Jordan River was flooding out of its banks. It was not a meandering trout stream in North Georgia or North Carolina. This was a raging river. And God looked at Joshua, not telling him how he was going to do it. He just said, I want you to get the people up, and I want you to get them across this river. Now, the second obstacle he faced is what I just said. God said, I want the people up, not down. Any pastor that's ever had an early morning service knows how difficult this command is right here. I want you to get the people up. I want you to get them spiritually ready to cross the river. That is an obstacle right there. And of course, these people, these rebellious people, have got to be moved across that river. So here's what you do. Number one, you identify the goal. Goal is, I want you over there in the land of Canaan. Number two, isolate the obstacles. The Jordan, the people, the fact that they were down and they were not up. Then here's the third thing you do. You investigate the benefits. You investigate the benefits. You ask yourself, if I'm going to reach this goal, what are my benefits? Now, let me tell you something, and I work with Fortune 500 companies as a motivational speaker, and I go in and I do goal-oriented workshops that last several hours at a stretch. Here's what I always tell people, and it is fundamentally, absolutely true. This is one of those laws of the universe. If the benefits do not outweigh the obstacles, you'll never accomplish the goal. If the benefits to reaching the goal do not outweigh the obstacles to reaching the goal, you will never get across your Jordan. You'll never do it. You'll never move into the area that you have identified as a goal. You need to investigate the benefits. You say, well, what are the benefits? Well, he says, I want you to go into the land which I am giving to them. I want you to go into the land. In other words, the benefit is, number one, that it's in the center of God's will. Number two, it's a land that flows with milk and honey. Number three, for the first time in their lives, for all of them, they will no longer be slaves or the 40-year nomads, but for the first time, they're going to be able to put down roots and they're going to be able to have a land that is their own. The benefits have got to outweigh the obstacles. They have to every time. Number four, involve the help of others. If you ever want to reach your goal, here's something you need to do. Always take other people along with you. Do not try to reach a goal and leave behind the people that are the most important. Do not try to reach a goal as a pastor and forget about your family, because I promise you it will come back to haunt you one day. When you're going to reach your goal, you take the people that are the nearest and dearest to you. Here's the way I say it in a goal setting workshop. Do not let your roles and your goals come in conflict with each other. In other words, determine what roles are the most important roles that you play, and then do not let your goals come in conflict, but make them work in harmony. Because if your roles and your goals conflict, you're going to lose your values, and when you lose your values, you've really lost what's going to give you success and significance in your life. So get the help of other people. Always take other people with you. You'll notice what he said there. Get up and cross the Jordan, you and all this people. He didn't say just you go. He said you're responsible for about 2.5 million people to get them there. Peter Drucker, the business guru, says, a man is never a success without a successor. In other words, mentor people, build people, grow the people that you are going to be sent out there to minister to. Number five, if you're going to be goal-oriented, invest in the plan. Invest in the plan. In other words, do you have conviction? Notice what he says in verse 3. Here is the mission statement that he gives to him in verse 3. the vision statement, I should say. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I've given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. He said, you're going to have to get out there and you're going to have to walk the land. Are you willing and do you have the conviction to do it yourself? So let me tell you, you will never lead people any further than you yourself are willing to go as their leader. If you want to know the temperature of any organization, Rick Warren says, stick the thermometer in the mouth of the leader and you'll find out just how far people will go. If you want them to do it, then you've got to be willing to do it yourself. Number six, initiate a completion date. If you're going to be a goal setter, you need to initiate a completion date. You say, well, I don't see that in the first nine verses. It's not. If you look in verses 10 and 11, though, it's there because he says, within 3 days, you're going to cross the Jordan. Now, think about this. Here's the guy that's been a servant to Moses all these years, served as his general. They have never gotten into the promised land. Moses dies, and now God looks at Joshua and says, in 3 days, you got to get them in there. In 3 days. That's what you call in the business world a graduated learning curve right there. All right? So then, number seven, involve God's power. Remember, the Lord your God is with you, verse 9, wherever you go. You need to involve God's power in what you're doing and not just try to do these things on your own. So then, you've got to have a purpose that's compelling. Big number two, and I'm only going to spend a moment here, you got to have a picture that's clear. You got to have a picture that's clear. And if you're going to have a clear picture, I think it starts with a mental picture that God will give to you of what's going to happen. He'll give you a vision. He will give you a clear mental image. And you need to learn to visualize it. You need to learn to verbalize it. And you need to learn to vitalize it. In other words, when I say visualize it, I mean see it. You need to learn to see it and ask God to give you a vision. And then when you verbalize it, you say it. So you see it and then you say it. And when you vitalize it, that means you take control of it. You seize it. So vitalize it, see it. Verbalize it, you say it. And when you vitalize it, that's when you seize it. You say, did Jesus do something like that? Absolutely. You want to know what Jesus' mission statement was? It's very simple. He said, I have come to do my Father's will. That was his mission statement. I have come to do my Father's will. I didn't come to do my own will. I came to do my Father's will. What was his vision statement? A real beautiful one. He said, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. You say, did he see it? Well, yeah, here's the way he said that. He said, I see people as sheep without a shepherd. Did he verbalize it? Absolutely, because we have his words written and read in the New Testament, so we know he said it. Did he seize it enough that he went to the cross and he died for the picture that he had of winning people and seeing people come to him? You got to have a motive that's pure, not only a mental picture, but a motive that's pure. You got to have virtue. You got to have a mission, a purpose, and know that you are going to make your life count. And then one thing that I'll briefly touch on, but you need to really think about, and I'm going to stop right here, is that you need to have a meditation process to get you there. If you're going to have a picture that's clear, you need to have a meditation process. And I'm not talking about Eastern meditation and humming a mantra and doing all kinds of different things and doing your ums. I'm talking about that you genuinely know how to meditate on the Word of God. Have you ever thought about that Joshua only had the first five books of the Bible to be able to meditate on? But God says to him there in verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you're going to meditate on it day and night. You know what that simply means? That it becomes such a part of your life that you do not compartmentalize your religion, but it's something that happens every day of your life. In the meditation process, you meditate upon the written word of God. When I went to work with Charles Stanley a few weeks ago, and I was talking to him, I asked him one day, I said, Dr. Stanley, I'm curious, who all do you read when you're preparing a sermon? Because Dr. Stanley has always spoken to me when I've watched him on In Touch. And he looked at me and he said, Ike, when I'm preparing the sermon, it's just me, my Bible, and God. I felt really carnal at that point because I was looking for a hidden author that might have been there that could have given me some insights. And then he talked about then the way he'll use the other resources. But he says, no, when I'm doing that part, he said, I start with just me and God and the Word, and I meditate on it. Also, the way you do it in the process is you think and you mature and you reflect. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8. And then you focus on God and not your circumstances. You focus on God, not your circumstances. I'll close with a little thing that happened to me the other day. Carmen, I was helping Abigail with her science project. And we were talking about when you pour a solute into a solvent, and I'm trying to make sure that I get all these words right, but when you pour a solute into a solvent, and when you've poured more of the solute than there is solvent, at a certain point, something, a process takes place called saturation. When saturation takes place and evaporation happens, it says that the solute will crystallize. And I got to thinking that the more of Jesus I pour into me and the less of the world I have, when the evaporation takes place all around me, the truths of God are absolutely crystal clear. Absolutely crystal clear. Do you have a mission? Do you know why you're here? Do you know why you exist? Are you committed to fulfilling that vision? I pray that you are today, because if it's a God-given vision, you'll be motivated beyond anything that anyone could ever do for you. When it's a God-given dream, I promise you, He'll help you to fulfill it.
Let me ask you to stand to your feet with your head bowed. This morning we're going to close our service with a choral benediction sung by faithful men. They have made their way to the balcony to close us out from there this morning. And so with our head bowed and our eyes closed, reflecting upon the challenge we have heard today from Ike, they will close us in our prayer, and then we'll be dismissed. So faithful men.